ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Tuesday, the 8th of July. I'm Isabella Higgins, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. It was the trial that captured the attention of the world and thrust a small Victorian town into the spotlight. 2 years after feeding her guests beef wellingtons containing death cap mushrooms, Erin Patterson has spent her first night behind bars as a convicted triple murderer. The case deeply affected those in the town of Morwell, which suddenly became swept up in an international media circus. Isabel Misali prepared this report.
How's she feeling, Colin?
Are you expecting to appear?
As Erin Patterson's defence barrister left court yesterday, the swarm of reporters was intense. A guilty verdict marked the end of a 10-week murder trial, which captured global attention.
And we knew immediately that this happened, we'd be covering this trial. It could have come off the pages of an Agatha Christie novel, but actually at the heart of this were real people.
Caroline Cheatham is the host and producer of UK podcast The Trial and is one of many storytellers who've made the trip to Morwell, Victoria for this case. She says interest has been big back home and it goes beyond a fascination with true crime.
It is mind-bogglingly bizarre that someone would set out to do this, and what we found out in this trial was there was careful planning dating back for very many months. And the fact that that happened and the fact that, you know, she succeeded, it blew people's minds.
The media, legal teams and a dedicated group of true crime fanatics have flooded Morwell, about 130 kilometres southeast of Melbourne and about 60 kilometres from the crime scene. The local council says spending was up by $300,000 during May compared to the same time last year, while nearby Traralgon saw a boost of $2.5 million. Pawinda Kaur is a local motel manager.
Yes, it's very positive. Not just the accommodation. Everyone's happy that people are coming to area and, you know, they're spending their money.
She says some businesses hope the fascination with the case continues, making Morwell a hit with true crime fans. Joseph Sistokas has seen a mixed impact. He's an exotic mushroom grower in Gippsland who supplies restaurants. Before the case, he was also selling at 4 farmers markets a month, but repetitive and condescending jokes made him scale back.
It was typically either these ones going to kill me or you from Lee and Gathack.
And he's faced challenging media questions too.
And the question was something like, should there be a national recall on mushrooms? And I just pushed back on that, said no way.
Back at the courthouse, podcaster Caroline Cheatham says it's important to remember 3 people were killed and Ian Wilkinson came close.
And he and his family and the Patterson family have walked into court every day, dignified, stoic, courageous, always with a smile on their faces. That's what this shows you, the very best of human beings and then the very worst of human beings.
UK podcaster Caroline Cheatham ending that report by Isabel Misali and Elizabeth Cramsey. Melbourne reporter Kathleen O'Connell was at the Supreme Court for the verdict. She joined me a short time ago. Kathleen, this isn't quite the end of the road for Erin Patterson. What comes next?
Yeah, that's right, Isabella. She spent the last night in prison, and what she will do next is anyone's guess. After the verdict was handed down, she was transported to Dame Phyllis Frost Centre here in Melbourne. It's a maximum security prison where she spent the last almost 2 years in police custody. It was about a 2.5-hour drive from the court in Morwell. She will stay here for the next month. In early August, the court will then come back for another hearing. And after that, Justice Christopher Beale will bring Erin Patterson back to court for sentencing. So that court hearing in early August, Justice Beale will hear from the prosecution and Erin Patterson's legal team. They'll have some discussion. And as I said, after that, she will then be considered for sentencing. The maximum penalty for murder in Victoria is life in prison, but it's not yet known how long she will spend behind bars. That will be a decision for Justice Christopher Beale. appeal. Following that, Erin Patterson and her legal team will then have the right to appeal the conviction. Her lawyer, Colin Mandy SC, left the court yesterday without saying a word, so we just don't know what their next steps will be at this stage.
And Kathleen, we've heard just how much this case has affected small, close-knit communities in regional Victoria. What happens there now this verdict has been handed down?
There's a sense of relief among community members in the regional towns of both Leongatha and Currumburra as Erin Patterson's guilty verdict was handed down in the Supreme Court yesterday. It was a massive 10-week trial, which was only predicted to go for around 6 weeks in the town of Morwell. But there was a great deal of evidence for the prosecution to go through. 125 pieces of evidence were shown to the jury, including text messages between Erin Patterson and her in-laws and pages from one of her victim's diary, her estranged husband's auntie, Heather Wilkinson. The sole survivor of the lunch, Ian Wilkinson, was not in court yesterday. He's been sitting inside the courtroom in Morwell for the last 10 weeks, giving testimony on how Erin Patterson poisoned him and how she killed his wife when serving the lunch guests death cap mushrooms at a lunch in 2023. He sat through that 2 months of evidence, and now Ian Wilkinson is back in the community trying to get back to some sort of normality. Now, there's a service that is going to be held at the Currumburra Baptist Church this Sunday at around 10:30 for members of the community to come together and talk about the incident and the trial itself. It's certainly a time for the immediate community members to come together and mourn the tragic deaths of Gail and Don Patterson and Heather Wilkinson. It is expected that Ian Wilkinson will be there and some members of Simon Patterson's family.
Kathleen O'Connor reporting. Donald Trump is reviving trade tensions. He's informing some countries of new tariff rates with his self-imposed pause on earlier tariffs soon set to expire. It's a busy day for the US president. He's also hosting the Israeli prime minister for dinner. North America correspondent Carrington Clark is in Washington. He joined me earlier.
Donald Trump has moved the date for when the so-called reciprocal tariffs will now kick in. It will now be August the 1st. But he's also sent out these letters, the first tranche of letters to certain countries, informing or threatening them, depending on your perspective, of what their tariff will be if they don't negotiate a deal with the United States. The first two were Japan and South Korea, both being informed that they will have a 25% tariff on all their exports to the United States. Now, this in part seems to be a negotiation tool. Donald Trump wants to do deals with countries in order to get better access for America to those markets, but also he seems to want other things as well, which seem to change depending on the day. But this appears to be clearly a response to the fact that they haven't been able to get deals with the vast majority of countries. When they announced the pause on the reciprocal tariffs, we had the trade advisor, Peter Navarro, saying that they could be doing 90 deals in 90 days. That just hasn't occurred. Really, the only deal we've seen was with the United Kingdom, and there were still some questions about the details of that deal. And we've seen a talk about deals with Vietnam and China. But Donald Trump still seems intent on having a high tariff policy in place. It should be pointed out, Australia is not expected to receive such a letter. We're only being hit with the so-called 10% baseline tariff, as well as facing higher tariffs for things like steel and aluminium. So we're not expected to be put into this position where we need to negotiate. But it does go to the heart of Donald Trump's trade policy. And we know that there is great concern among economists, that, of course, that if these tariffs are put in place in the way that they were first expressed, then we will see higher prices for American consumers.
And Carrington, there's lots happening in Washington. What can we expect from this meeting between Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu?
Yeah, so this is the third visit by Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, to the White House since Donald Trump took back the reins of power. But interestingly, this meeting will be away from the prying eyes of the world's media. It's going to be a dinner meeting between the Prime Minister of Israel and Donald Trump. Donald Trump last week said he was going to be firm with Benjamin Netanyahu when it comes to getting a ceasefire agreement between Israel and Hamas, which would see both the hostages that are still being held by Hamas released, but also obviously a ceasefire to stop the bombardment of Gaza, which has effectively leveled the Gaza Strip and displaced almost all the people who live there, as well as around 60,000 lives lost. But although Donald Trump says he thinks there is space for a ceasefire agreement to be done this week, we are seeing these indirect talks between Hamas and Israel in Qatar taking place, and there's been no breakthrough there. So at this point, it's hard to see how there could be a substantial breakthrough today, and the fact that this meeting is being held so privately maybe indicates that he, Donald Trump, is not overly confident that a deal will be struck today.
Carrington Clark in Washington. It's been 20 years since suicide bombers terrorised London's public transport network in a deadly attack which became known as the 7/7 bombings. Memorial services have been taking place to remember the 52 people who were killed and hundreds more who were injured when four homemade bombs were detonated on trains and a bus during peak hour. Europe correspondent Bridget Rollison was at the commemoration service in London and filed this report.
Inside St Paul's Cathedral, hundreds pause to remember the day London was stunned by the 7/7 bombings, which changed the city forever.
King's Cross, Russell Square.
52 people were killed, many on their way to work, when four homemade devices were detonated on trains and a bus during peak hour. Families and survivors were joined by members of the royal family, the UK Prime Minister, and emergency service workers to mark two decades since the evil attack. Graham Fawkes's son, David, was killed catching the tube at Edgware Road.
When four bombs exploded on the 7th of July 2005, lives were destroyed and the flame of hope faltered for what seemed like an eternal moment. For many people, nothing was the same again.
Ladies and gents, we need to clear now Russell Square.
On that day, four suicide bombers linked to terror organisation Al-Qaeda detonated bombs on London's underground train system. The devices exploded on tubes beneath Liverpool Street, King's Cross and Edgware Road at 8:50 in the morning. A fourth bomb exploded an hour later on a bus. The service honoured the victims, as well as the bravery of those who ran towards the danger to help strangers. Saba Edwards's mother, Benos, was killed at King's Cross. She broke down as she read out the names of those murdered in the attack.
Benos Mazako. Michaela Otto. Atik Sharifi.
British Prime Minister Sir Keir Starmer said those who had tried to divide the country failed as he laid a wreath at the 7/7 memorial in Hyde Park. While in his message to the country, King Charles called for a spirit of unity and said the attacks had shown the importance of building a society where people of all faiths and backgrounds can live together. The 7th of July was a dark day in Britain's history. But reflections 20 years on have highlighted the strength and courage of the nation. Mr. Fawkes says London has remained a place of hope.
Because the good which is in Londoners is not erased by hatred or by threat, or rather is fostered to produce a harvest of hope for each generation.
This is Bridget Rollison in London, reporting for AM.
Mortgage borrowers around the country are holding their breath, with the Reserve Bank later today announcing its decision on interest rates. Here's business correspondent David Taylor.
Sydney woman Nia Pandoulis is juggling a full-time job with a fashion side hustle. She's hoping lower interest rates will help her get a foot on the property ladder.
Yes, if there are lower interest rates, I think I'd entertain looking at buying my first home.
And maybe also put more money in her customers' pockets to spend on her fashion items.
Consumers will have a little bit more of a disposable income, and us as a business, we get to, you know, not be strangled by those additional costs. And that's what we want. If we want to grow and really get ourselves out there in that market, we would really benefit from that.
Economists and financial markets are betting the Reserve Bank will cut interest rates today. AMP Deputy Chief Economist Deanna Musina.
Well, it sort of looks like a no-brainer that the Reserve Bank's going to cut the cash rate again at its July board meeting. There's more than a 90% chance priced into financial markets at the moment.
According to interest rate comparison website Mozo, this means owner-occupier borrowers with a $500,000 mortgage could save $76 a month or $918 over a year on their home loan repayments. And Diana Musina says there may be as many as 4 interest rate cuts by early 2026.
We do think that the Reserve Bank is going to keep cutting interest rates. So we're looking for another 4 rate cuts at least in the cycle, 3 of those to take place over the rest of this year and then 1 in early 2026.
But other economists aren't so confident the RBA will drop interest rates. BetaShares chief economist David Bassanese.
I think it makes sense to wait for confirmation of good underlying inflation declines in the quarterly CPI, which comes out late in July.
So the bottom line is that you don't think there is any urgency to cut interest rates?
No, I don't see the urgency. I mean, the labour market is still pretty solid. Unemployment has barely budged. It's still around 4%.
Independent economist Sherman Chan agrees.
And also, let's not forget, productivity is still a very weak point for our economy, and that is a risk to our inflation outlook over the medium term.
Property prices may also be a factor in the Reserve Bank's interest rate deliberations. Cotality's Eliza Owen says lower rates push property prices up.
A reduction in interest rates is kind of like a price cut on the cost of debt. So that increases the maximum that people can borrow for mortgages.
That's not good news for Nia Pandoulis's dreams of home ownership.
I feel like as someone that's sort of in Sydney, I think the reality is that would get pushed further and further out. And I would like to stay from where I grew up.
The Reserve Bank will announce its interest rates decision at 2:30 p.m. Australian Eastern Standard Time.
Business correspondent David Taylor reporting. Indigenous leaders in the Northern Territory are fighting to keep their clan dialects from disappearing. A 2019 survey by the Australian Institute of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Studies found that only 12 out of 250 Indigenous languages around before colonisation are still being passed on to younger generations. In recent years, dozens of communities have worked hard to stop further extinction. Tilda Colling reports.
3 years ago, the United Nations issued a dire warning. Australia was one of dozens of countries facing a mass extinction event. But it wasn't flora or fauna that was at risk of being lost. It was languages.
Language is important for us. If we don't speak it, we will lose it.
Renfrewd Mayor Marulu is from the South Goulburn Islands, off the northern coast of the Northern Territory. He speaks Hmong, one of hundreds of Indigenous languages around Australia. Hmong is more than words. For him, it's woven into the fabric of his culture in practices like songlines.
It's the window of who you are and where you're from.
In 2022, the UN knew the situation was dire. 40% of an estimated 6,700 mostly Indigenous languages around the world were in danger of disappearing. They declared it the International Decade of Indigenous Languages. IATSIS's language director, Lauren Reed, says Australia was no stranger to this language loss.
So over half of our Indigenous languages in Australia now are only spoken by elders. So that means that without urgent action during this decade and beyond, we stand the chance of those languages falling out of use altogether.
In the last 3 years, she's seen a shift.
There are signs of hope that have been growing since the beginning of the decade.
Ms. Reid says the federal government has since recognised the crisis and set up a national policy partnership. But the strongest programs to save languages have been driven by communities working with elders and archives.
Over 30 communities are working hard to revitalise, reawaken and strengthen their languages to turn that tide of language loss.
In the top end, the effort's been led in part by Rurichwe Melanie Herman, a speaker of endangered language Dangu.
It gives me strength to work in the way that I want to and support language continuation in my community. But it goes back to who you are, it's your foundation. And without language, we're lost.
Recently, her family member, an elder and Dangu speaker, passed away. She said the next generation needs to learn the language before it's too late.
Our language is being lost, and the knowledge of speaking Dangu in particular needs to be maintained and it needs to be supported.
The Top End Languages Forum's report is expected to be finalised next month, including a series of recommendations by leaders from over 30 language groups.
Tilda Colling reporting, and that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Isabella Higgins.
Hello, I'm Sydney Peed, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Younger Australians between 30 and 40 years old are increasingly being diagnosed with cancer, and scientists are desperate to understand why. Today, Dr. Norman Swan on his Four Corners report into what could be causing the sharp rise. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.